Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. The Upper Credit Humane Society faces eviction after 30 years spent at the same address in Erin, Ontario.
We've been on that property for 23 years, operating very well as an animal shelter. We've never had a single complaint.
The National Youth Orchestra will play in Nanaimo, and a local musician gets to live his dream.
I was super excited when I got that email. Wow, I was kind of in disbelief, but I was so happy. It just feels very special.
Montreal's Historical Fencing Society is keeping medieval brawls alive.
You get to see people be skillful, have weapons, hit each other, actually put like all their energy in showing their basically their craft, their skills, their weapon mastery, and it is so adrenaline worthy, even if you're in the crowd.
A new public art project brings color to Kingston's downtown as local artists take over the traffic control boxes.
Normally these boxes are just painted black, so they're like a really great just blank canvas.
And to Nova Scotia, where the government's plans for offshore wind farms nets opposition from Cape Breton fishermen.
The days of exporting our talent and watching opportunities sail away, they're over. From now on, we're not exporting our people. Instead, we'll be exporting clean energy and keeping our people at home because we need them.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, happy to have you with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next 30 minutes. And in good company, might I say, with our reporters posted across the country from east to west, and that's where we'll be. We take off in Fergus, Ontario, where the Upper Credit Humane Society, or UCHS, a long-standing pillar of animal care in the town of Erin, has been told that its lease at 5383 Trafalgar Road will not be renewed beyond May 2028. The Humane Society provides many services such as rescuing, rehabilitating, and rehoming animals. Town officials confirmed the decision, saying they wish to maximize the property's value for taxpayers. They added that they have been open and transparent with the UCHS, clearly communicating that their current use of the property does not comply with the town's zoning bylaw and official plan policies. Earlier this year, the UCHS proposed transforming the site into a modern multi-use community hub with expanded shelter space, public trails, education facilities, and a dog park. The plan was even supported by local residents and the Erin Chamber of Commerce. So the Upper Credit Humane Society is fighting back and asking the community for help. The organization hopes public pressure can help secure a future for the shelter, either at its current site or at a new location. Paul Arriott in Fergus, Ontario.
It's been a staple in the area for 30 years, and after 23 years in its current location, the Upper Credit Humane Society is looking for a new home. UCHS Chair Susan Thompson says they're in a difficult situation.
The town of Erin has decided they're not going to renew our lease after May of 2028, which means that we're in a bit of a difficult situation. We need to convince them to let us stay, which is our number one priority, or we need to find a new location, or unfortunately, we would have to look at closing the shelter.
Thompson says the reason given for not renewing their lease was a bit curious.
What they told us is that they want to maximize the value of the property for the taxpayers. They basically told us that we don't meet the zoning requirements of the property. The reason that that's seems a bit strange is that we've been on that property for 23 years, operating very well as an animal shelter. We've never had a single complaint. It's a great location. Everybody knows where we are. We're sort of central for our region. And the property itself is zoned what they call OS1, Open Space 1, which is a bit of a catch-all and primarily includes community use, recreational centers, and things like that. So our argument would be, why not just grandfather us into that? There is no other zoning for an animal shelter. So why not just add animal shelter into that zoning to be the reason?
The Humane Society, although hopeful they'll be able to convince the town to remain in their current location, They're also realistic about looking for alternative options.
We realize that we need to be not put all of our eggs in one basket. Right now, we're hoping to put a lot of just public pressure to stay where we are. We would like to have people sign our petition. We're hoping that the town will hold a town hall where the community actually gets to talk to them, tell them what their vision is, since this property is owned by the people. You know, it's owned by the town, so it's owned by the people. But at the same time, we realize that we need to be looking elsewhere. So people who have property that might be suitable for an animal shelter or a portion of property, we need about 2 acres or a little bit less than 2 acres in terms of space. And certainly we're prepared to do fundraising to put a building on it and all of that.
The current lease expires in May 2028, but building a new location will take time. They're asking concerned residents to sign their online petition at uppercredit.com. I'm Paul Harriet, reporting from the Local Journalism Initiative.
So welcome to Paul Harriet, the latest addition to the English team of frequencynews.ca. This was his first story on Viewpoints 2.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
A group of Montrealers spent one Monday night a month swinging real swords at each other while a bar full of people cheered and heckled. They were all there to watch what is called fencing. Fencing is a local combat sport. It's highly theatrical to watch. You can also see it on stage a lot in Shakespeare's plays, for example. The weapons are real, the danger to an extent is too, and the methods are all researched and practiced at length. Montreal journalist Adam Minnis attended a fight night, a showcase put on in Bar L'Hémisphère Gauche by Montreal's Historical Fencing Society. He spoke with Historical Fencing Society founders Xavier Sierra and Victoria Adelard about their sport, the research involved, its entertainment factor, and its safety.
Some people spend their Monday nights watching TV, maybe eating with friends or family, and heading off to bed. But we found a group of Montrealers who, once a month, spend their Monday nights swinging swords at each other in a high-risk combat sport called historical fencing. You're hearing sounds from the, quote, bear pit at Bar Hémisphère Gauche during Fight Night. That's K-N-I-G-H-T night. These well-attended events see people dressed head-to-toe in medieval regalia, brandishing swords and shields that they often forge themselves, fighting no holds barred until tap out, while a crowd cheers and heckles for more. These events are showcases from Montreal's Historical Fencing Guild. The Historical Fencing Guild is a gym that combines historical research with combat sports to create a whole new pastime. Or maybe it's not new at all. Here's gym co-founder Xavier Sierra, also known as the Dark Knight.
We follow European sources for the most part that just deal with how to do combat, armored, without armor, with every single type of weapon you can imagine. And we read those sources from like the 14th century and then try to reapply them, see what works in a real combat situation, and we evolve from that.
And here is the gym's other co-founder, Victoria Allard, known as the Valkyrie.
We offer lessons every day of the week and the different weapons you see at the show, longsword, side sword, etc. And basically, this is where we practice and learn all the techniques we get to demonstrate tonight. You get to see people be skillful, have weapons, hit each other, actually put like all their energy in showing their, basically, their craft, their skills, their weapon mastery, and it is so adrenaline-worthy, even if you're in the crowd.
Listeners, you might be wondering if this is safe. The answer is not exactly. We asked why Allard was wearing a cast on her arm. Here's what she told us.
I was with my opponent, and then their sword got cut in my glove, and when they retreated, they bent my finger backwards. And basically, it's actually the finger that's completely broken.
At that point, did you continue fighting, or was the fight called?
So the medic came to see me and said that they didn't know the extent of the injury, and I decided to continue the fight, and actually did four more fights after that and won two of them.
Whether these fights will continue with only minor incident is yet to be seen, but the Historical Fencing Guild continues to be a place for those wishing to bring history close. Really, really close. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
A local Nanaimo musician has reached a life goal. He will be playing on a hometown show while on tour with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada. Musician Liam Pister can't see himself doing anything else besides music. At a young age, he first found a passion for music, playing the piano, a passion that later led him to play the clarinet. Now, Pister's musical talent has taken him to the National Youth Orchestra of Canada. He has been dreaming about it for years. Lauren McKenzie spoke with Liam Pister ahead of his first hometown performance with the youth orchestra.
Liam Pistor's passion for music started when his parents first put him in piano lessons in elementary school after his music teacher saw talent in him. His passion for music led him to play the clarinet in high school band. And now he's putting his musical talent to use on tour with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada for their 65th anniversary.
Thing is, with music, I can't really see myself doing anything else. I think music has just been something that's always been a part of my life.
After high school, Pistor studied piano performance at the University of Victoria, where he got experience with the Greater Victoria Youth Orchestra. He then went to Western University for a master's degree in piano, followed by a diploma in clarinet performance at UBC. He says performing with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada has been a long-time goal of his, but he wasn't able to audition every year that he was eligible due to focusing on education and the COVID-19 pandemic.
But I found the time for it this year, and I worked really hard on my audition and just really making sure that the music, the excerpts that I had to do, really matched the style of the composer and that I was having the right amount of musicality. And I was very lucky to get in this year, and I'm very excited about it. I was super excited when I got that email. Like, wow, I was kind of in disbelief, but I was so happy.
While he's done a lot of solo work with the piano and clarinet, he says there's something special about performing with others.
It's like you're not just playing what you're playing, but you're also responding to what's happening around you, and it just feels very special.
The age range of the youth orchestra is 16 to 28. And as one of the older musicians, he says it's inspiring to be able to play alongside younger musicians. The 65th anniversary tour has already started with performances in Ontario and will be performing in Nanaimo on Wednesday, July 30th. The performance will be at the Port Theatre with tickets on sale on the theatre's website. What music is performed varies by location, giving the orchestra a wide repertoire to perform throughout the tour.
I'm really looking forward to the Prokofiev Violin Concerto No. 2. That's the one I'm looking forward to the most. I'm principal clarinet for that one, and it's going to be performed in Nanaimo.
Pistor says it's an amazing feeling being able to perform with the youth orchestra in Nanaimo. He says his family already has tickets for the performance at the Port Theatre. As well, his high school music teacher and other friends and family will be in the audience. He says this show is a very special opportunity to show his friends and family the work he's been training for his whole life.
Feels amazing. It's one thing to be able to say that you were in the National Youth Orchestra, but to be able to show that experience to your family and friends is just even more exciting and more special.
Following the performance in Nanaimo, the National Youth Orchestra of Canada will perform several shows in Victoria from August 1st to the 3rd.
Thanks to Lauren McKenzie in Nanaimo, British Columbia. We move to Ontario now, where Kingston's new traffic control box project is transforming overlooked street infrastructure into vibrant public art. The initiative, led by the municipality, aims to brighten the downtown core and support local artists by turning traffic control boxes into open-air canvases. Five artists have been commissioned to create and install pieces in their own unique mediums and styles. The city's public art coordinator, Taylor Norris, hopes that the project can expand next summer, adding more color to the unexpected corners of the city. Christina Lori, based in Kingston, Ontario, spoke with local artist Abby Nowakowski and Taylor Norris while they were working on a piece entitled Finding Home Between the Cactails and Trilliums.
At the bustling street corner of Princess and Montreal Street, local artist Abby Nowakowski is hard at work painting a seldom-noticed traffic control box with the help of the city's public art coordinator, Taylor Norris. Nowakowski described her critter-inspired piece, Finding Home Between the Cattails and the Trilliums.
The piece itself is inspired by lots of local critters that are here. So we've got like a northern flicker, great blue heron, trilliums, cattails, a fox, a turtle. And I chose all of those creatures by, I reach out to kind of my community on socials and ask like, you know, Kingston folks, what kind of critters would you like to see in this mural? So try to fit as many as possible onto this box.
This piece is part of the Traffic Control Box Pilot Project, an initiative to brighten downtown by transforming traffic control boxes along Princess Street into vibrant pieces of public art. The project aims to support local artists, bring vibrancy to the downtown core, while also helping to deter graffiti. The city has commissioned five local artists working in different styles and mediums: Ben Nelson, Grace Dixon, Sasha Jimenez French, Aaron Wen, and Abby Nowakowski. Norris noted that local businesses and city staff have been advocating for this initiative to bring some more color downtown. Norris shared a bit more about this project with CFRC.
So for the first phase of this project, I have been working with local artists to sort of experiment with using these traffic control boxes as a platform for public art in downtown Kingston. So we're doing two different strategies. We're going to do a couple that are painted with murals. So that's what Abby and I are doing today. And then two others will be done in a vinyl wrap, just to see how the project works, how the community likes it, if painting is better than vinyl, if they both work. So for this first phase, I directly commissioned artists through our temporary public art program and our policy were able to do that. So I invited Abby. I had seen her mural work before and I thought it would be a great addition to the pilot project to experiment with. And I know that Abby would be a really good fit for this location at Montreal and Princess in front of Rocking Horse. So that's, yeah. Normally these boxes are just painted black. They hold all the controls for traffic lights at every intersection that has them. So they're like a really great, just blank canvas.
For artists like Nowakowski, opportunities like this have been few and far between in the past. But she notes the landscape is changing with projects like this.
Opportunities like this been becoming more abundant in Kingston. What's kind of the landscape that we're looking at?
That's a really good question. I feel like I want to say yes, that it has become more abundant, but I think that's because there's people like Taylor who are actively wanting to create and advocate for opportunities. But with that advocating, we need more funding, right? So the more people see cool things like this and appreciate, it means there's going to be in the future more need and want for artists to be paid for, you know, creating culture in Kingston, because there's so many local artists here. So it's nice to kind of pull on what we already have happening here in Kingston.
Artists are also adapting, making sure they're ready to take on unique opportunities.
Being an artist today means like wearing a lot of different hats. When we get access to, you know, art making opportunities, paid art making proper opportunities, it's easy to jump on them and say a hard yes, because those type of opportunities unfortunately don't come up that often. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be gifted this opportunity.
With this first wave of public art underway, Norris hopes the project can continue to bring color to unexpected places.
I mean, we've got no shortage of these traffic control boxes across the city, and we've got no shortage of like pre-existing like utilitarian architecture and infrastructure that can be activated as platforms for public art. So this first phase, we're working out all the kinks, you know, the boxes are all in different condition. So what are the prep needs? What is the cost of prep? Like, what contractors do I need to work with? What work do I need to do? What artists will work best? You know, it takes 3 to 4 days to install a mural, so that requires us to be on site. So that means we have to navigate weather, traffic, all those sorts of things. And then with the vinyl, it gives me an opportunity to work with artists who work in digital mediums, digital illustration, graphic design. And then those boxes require a different level of support and prep to get the art onto those. So I'm hoping we'll see how everything goes over the winter, see how the murals last, what damage happens, if any, hopefully not, and then the community feedback. And ideally, we'll be able to expand the program next summer to more and more locations across the city.
Two boxes are complete and three are still in progress, and passersby downtown are already taking notice.
We're just really excited to be able to get more ground level opportunities.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not used to making in such a public sphere, so it's actually been such a nice and validating thing to be actively making and having the people who will be admiring this for the next little while. And, you know, this is ultimately, they're all going to own this piece basically, because now this is going to be in their neighborhood. So to hear everyone kind of being like, oh, that's so nice, it makes us feel good. Yeah.
No, it's great. It's been really positive, and a lot of people didn't even know these boxes were here. Mm-hmm. So now that they've got these murals on them, they're like, how long has this box been here? And we're like, over a decade. So yeah, just to be able to bring some vibrancy and like beautiful art to a street corner will hopefully, you know, brighten everybody's day as they pass by, kind of thing.
This has been Christina Laurie with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
An area of the coast of Cape Breton has been designated for offshore wind development. The section of water just outside Sydney Harbour, known as Sydney Bight, is one of four provincial areas in the North Atlantic Ocean deemed as prime real estate for offshore wind energy. Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston says the project will enable the province to be a key player in providing the country's future energy needs. But not everyone is on board with offshore wind development in Sydney Bight, such as lobster fisherman Herb Nash. Nash says this site could be a problem during fishing season because it limits their catch area, not to mention the extra fuel and time it will take to navigate around the turbines. Nash says he's not opposed to green energy, but he believes wind farms belong on land. Bill McCouche.
An area off the coast of Cape Breton has been designated for offshore wind development. The section of water just outside of Sydney Harbour in the North Atlantic, known as Sydney Bight, is one of four areas off the coast of Nova Scotia deemed as prime real estate for offshore wind energy. It's not known yet how many turbines will be located in Sydney Bight, but construction for all four areas is expected to start by 2033. Premier Tim Houston says the project will enable Nova Scotia to be a key player in providing the country's future energy needs while varying away from dependence south of the border.
It is a chance to make Nova Scotia and the rest of Canada more self-sufficient. We don't want to rely on the U.S. for energy, like natural gas flowing through the states to reach us. We want our own made in Nova Scotia solutions and the opportunity to become a net exporter of clean energy. The days of exporting our talent and watching opportunities sail away, they're over. From now on, we're not exporting our people. Instead, we'll be exporting clean energy and keeping our people at home, because we need them. We're going to need every hand, every skill, every community to make this a reality, because there's a lot of work ahead and we welcome it. The momentum behind this is like nothing I've seen before, and we're all pulling in the same direction.
Houston mentions communities of all types need to be involved, but not everyone is on board with offshore wind development in Sydney Bight, such as lobster fisherman Herb Nash. Nash tells Coast Radio the site could be a problem during fishing season because it limits their catch area, not to mention the extra time and fuel it will take to navigate around the turbines.
It's still a spot that you're not going to be able to drive through or something. You're going to have to go around it every time you want to go get to the other side. Instead of just steaming through it, you're going to be going around a great big square or something. So, like, I still can't figure out why they can't put down land.
Nash says he's not opposed to green energy, but he believes wind farms belong on land.
Yeah, I think they should have looked on the land. There's all kinds of land in Cape Breton. Look at the mountains down north and that. They could have put them down there somewhere. Like, somebody would have sold them land down there. There's people down there got land that they would have sold them. It's just to get the money for some of the land they got, you know, that was passed down over generations and that. So then if they have something break down or something, they just drive to it to fix instead of going out in the boat and trying to get it fixed and that.
Meanwhile, Houston says the sea brings many resources to the province and offshore energy supports an increase in energy demand, resulting in profits for Nova Scotia because the technology is more desirable when it's fresh on the market.
This is a new opportunity. The wind has always been there, but I think there's a number of factors that are kind of lining up. One is just the incredible demand for electricity. Everything's being electrified, so there's incredible demand. I think the desire for more renewable is certainly playing into, you know, and just the pure economics of it. You know, everybody knows the first VCR was a lot more expensive than the one today. And my family bought the Betamax. They did the wrong. So you got to be a certain vintage to know what that means. But I think the price of the technology, the understanding of the opportunity is all it's advanced to a certain stage that this is the economics start to work quite a bit better. And I think it's really important that when you think about the economics and the price of this wind, people say, well, it's expensive. And sure, it's more expensive than coal and more expensive than some other formats. But really, as governments and as industry are looking at the price of energy now, they're interested in what they've already paid or what they pay in the past. But what they're really interested in is what do they have to pay for the next electron, because they need it.
The province requires roughly 2.5 gigawatts of power at peak demand, but Houston says Nova Scotia has the potential to generate as much as 40 gigawatts, providing plenty for other areas of the country. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush, Coast Radio News.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists Adam Innes, Christina Laurie, Lauren McKenzie, Paul Harriet, and Bill McCush. National editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks to you and to your station for keeping us company this week. And until the next, ciao.